Welcome to the debate. Imagine dropping a piece of plastic into a murky, particle-filled fluid and, well, watching as an invisible force field pushes all the dirt and suspended particles away.
It's wild to watch.
Right? What you're left with is this massive, perfectly clear halo of pure water surrounding the material. It sounds like a scene out of a science fiction movie, but it happens right in front of our microscopes.
It really is a visually arresting phenomenon. I mean, you take a polymer, something like Nafion, which is a synthetic material often used in fuel cells.
Yeah, exactly.
And you drop it into an aqueous suspension of microparticles, and almost instantly, this massive particle-free zone forms right at the boundary.
Yeah, scientists call these regions exclusion zones, or EZs. And, well, that brings us to the core of our discussion today. The debate isn't about whether this visual effect is real.
Nah, we all see it happening.
Right. It's about what it actually means. Like, does this exclusion zone reveal a fundamentally new organized state of water, a phase that actively drives biological functions in living cells?
Or, and this is the side I lean toward, is this striking halo entirely explainable by standard, conventional physics? You know, things we already understand, like electrical fields and ion exchange.
And it's a vital question because, well, how we answer it changes how we view the basic building blocks of biology. To dig into this, we're looking at a recent academic white paper by Dr. Bishara Sahali titled From the Fourth Phase to the Living Interface.
Yeah, he synthesized a tremendous amount of experimental evidence to propose what he calls an emergent non-equilibrium interface model.
Right. To put it simply, I am very much on the side of this emergent model. I think it shows us that water isn't just an inert background fluid, you know?
Like a passive bathtub?
Exactly. It's not a passive bathtub where all the real biological actors do their work. It's an active, structural participant in life. The surface chemistry and the water dynamics create what the paper calls a living interface.
I'm actually on the other side of this. I think we can explain this entire force field effect using standard transport mechanisms. I just don't believe we need to invent novel states of water to understand what's happening in that petri dish.
Even with the massive scale of the zones?
Even with the scale. I mean, I think processes like diffusophoresis and unequal ionic diffusion can quantitatively, mathematically explain the exclusion zones we see.
Well, let's unpack that because it's a lot of terminology for anyone not deep in biophysics. When Gerald Pollack originally observed these massive clear zones, he proposed what Dr. Saleh rightly calls a Copernican proposition.
Which was quite the leap.
Well, it was bold. He suggested that the water itself was organizing into a structural lattice, literally pushing the particles away because the water matrix was too tight to let them in. You're saying that's not what's happening at all.
Right, not at all. I'm looking at the independent findings of Florey and Esplandieu, which are, you know, heavily cited in the source material. They did some brilliant work showing exactly how these long-range displacements happen without needing a new phase of water.
So walk us through it.
Okay, so Nafion is an ionomer. Essentially, it has these little acidic groups on its surface that pump protons out into the surrounding water.
Like a chemical fountain?
Exactly, like a fountain. So you have this massive release of positive ions flowing out into the bulk water, and this creates an electrochemical gradient.
Right.
Now, we have a very well-understood mechanism in physics called diffusophoresis. If you're listening at home, think of diffusophoresis like a raft floating down a river. But instead of water current pushing the raft, it's a chemical gradient pushing the particles.
Pushing them physically away from the surface.
Right. The Nafion is pumping protons, creating an electrical field, and that field physically sweeps the tracer particles away. The visible edge of an exclusion zone is just the operational boundary of that electrical field. We have to be incredibly careful not to confuse the movement of a plastic tracer bead with a macroscopic structural change in the water itself.
I see the logic there. And, you know, quantifying the proton pump is crucial, but let's look at the sheer scale of the phenomenon. These exclusion zones aren't just microscopic blips.
Well, they're big, sure.
They can extend tens, sometimes hundreds of micrometers out from the surface. In the cellular world, 100 micrometers is an absolute canyon. Even if transport physics like diffusophoresis are at play, doesn't the sheer macroscopic scale imply some sort of underlying sustained organization of the water to facilitate a field that large?
Not necessarily. I mean, think about it this way. A field can extend much, much further than the material generating it. Gravity extends hundreds of thousands of miles beyond the Earth, But space isn't made of rock.
Okay, but...
A magnetic field extends past the bounds of a magnet, but the air around it hasn't turned into iron. The Nafion acts as an electrochemical battery. It sets up a field in the water, and that field pushes the particles. It doesn't mean the water is now ice.
Okay, fair enough. But we have more than just the tracer beads moving around. We actually have ways to look at the water molecules themselves. The paper discusses Raman microscopy studies on living cells.
Right, the vibrational mapping.
Exactly. For those unfamiliar, Raman spectroscopy is where you shine a specialized laser at a sample and measure how the light scatters when it hits chemical bonds. It essentially lets you map the vibrational signature of molecules.
It's a great tool.
It is. And through this mapping, researchers have identified that about 3% of the water inside a living cell has a reproducibly non-bulk-like spectrum. The hydrogen bond network is weakened. It's more disordered. If this is all just standard ions floating down a chemical river in ordinary background water, why do we see distinct molecular signatures right at these biological interfaces?
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Okay, go ahead. Finding 3% non-bulk water in a highly crowded cellular environment is completely standard. We're talking about nanoscopic molecular hydration here. This is exactly what mainstream biophysics expects when water molecules bump up against the densely packed surfaces of proteins, lipid membranes, and DNA.
But it proves the water is changing on a nanometer scale. A nanometer scale hydration shell around a protein is a fundamentally different physical beast than a macroscopic exclusion zone hundreds of micrometers thick. The leap in logic here is massive. You are taking a very real microscopic effect where water behaves slightly differently right against a surface and stretching it to macroscopic proportions without justification.
Wait, let me clarify, because I think you're misrepresenting the position. I'm not claiming the entire hundreds of micrometers zone is one solid static ice crystal. That's a total straw man of the emergent model.
How so?
Model C, as proposed in the paper, is about an emergent interface. The nanoscopic changes in the water couple dynamically with the surface, which in turn couples with the ions. It's a cascading reciprocal organization. It's not a block of ice.
But the existence of that overarching organization is directly challenged by a very simple experiment. I mean, look at the gradient neutralization test.
The buffer experiment.
Yes. If we clamp the battery, the force field disappears. If you add a chemical buffer to the water to neutralize the proton gradient generated by the Nafion, the long-range forces completely vanish. The exclusion zone collapses.
Right, because you killed the gradient.
But if there were an independent macroscopic organization of water maintaining that space, it should persist, at least partially, independent of the ion gradient. But it doesn't. The tracer exclusion is driven entirely by the surface pumping ions. When the pump stops, the zone dies.
Okay, well, if we are going to use the battery analogy, let's follow it to its logical conclusion. Batteries run out of juice.
They do. If you just have a chemical gradient pushing particles, eventually the system reaches equilibrium and stops. But this system sustains itself. So let's look at the energetic inputs that keep those forces going, specifically radiant energy. You're talking about the illumination experiments.
Yes. The findings by Chai and Pollock. They discover that when you expose the interface to radiant energy, like light, the exclusion zone drastically expands. And it's not just any light.
Right, it's specific.
Exquisitely specific. It is sensitive to 3.1 micrometer infrared radiation. That specific wavelength corresponds directly to the OH stretching frequency of water. It's like hitting the exact resonant frequency of a tuning fork, but for the oxygen-hydrogen bonds in the water molecule.
Sure, I agree with the resonance part.
Right. And when you hit the system with that specific wavelength, the exclusion zone grows several fold. The interface is literally absorbing electromagnetic energy to build and sustain structural order. It operates as an energy transducing system. You can't explain a sustained, light-driven expansion like that with a simple passive battery model.
See, I come at it from a different way.
Okay.
You say the system is absorbing 3.1 micrometer infrared radiation to build structural order. I say it's absorbing 3.1 micrometer infrared radiation and simply getting hot.
Just getting hot? That's a bit reductive, isn't it?
Fundamentally, no. It's thermodynamics. Absorbing infrared radiation inherently generates localized heat.
The source material by Dr. Sadi Hueli is very explicit about this critique. Molecular absorption of mid-infrared radiation intentionally generates local heat.
But that doesn't account for...
Hold on. What happens when you heat up a liquid? You change its refractive index, and more importantly, you accelerate the kinetic energy of the molecules. You accelerate the ion exchange and the diffusion rates.
But Pollack's group addressed the temperature question directly. They put sensors in the chambers and reported that the bulk temperature elevations were incredibly modest, like fractions of a degree. It wasn't boiling the water.
Ah, but modest bulk temperature changes in the whole petri dish do not exclude intense local thermal gradients right at the microscopic interface.
You're assuming a huge local disparity.
Well, if you shine a laser at a tiny point, the overall room temperature doesn't change, but that exact point is scorching. The paper points out a major methodological flaw here. To prove that this is a magical, non-thermal water battery storing light as structural energy, you have to run equal flux, spatially matched thermal controls.
Meaning you have to heat the interface exactly the same way without using the light.
Exactly. You have to physically reproduce the exact same three-dimensional temperature field at the boundary without the illumination, and then see if the EZ still expands.
And until then?
Until that rigorous control is done, the most logical explanation is standard thermodynamics. The light heats the boundary. The heat accelerates the diffusion of protons out of the Nafion. A stronger proton pump means a stronger electrical field, and a stronger electrical field pushes the tracer beads further away. Classical thermodynamics explains this beautifully without needing to invent a new paradigm of water.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on how this system processes energy over time. Because your explanation treats the interface as a completely instantaneous, stateless system, like a billiard ball reacting only to the immediate heat or the immediate gradient of the moment.
Because that's what physics is at that scale.
But the interface isn't stateless. It possesses operational memory.
Memory? I'm sorry, water doesn't have a memory.
Not a cognitive memory, obviously, but a path-dependent physical history. The paper highlights that water sorption in Nafion is strongly non-Fickian.
Right, and for our listeners, Fickian just refers to standard, steady diffusion, like a drop of food coloring spreading evenly in a glass of water. Non-Fickian means it doesn't follow that simple mathematical spread.
Exactly. The system's response at any given moment depends entirely on its prior conditioning. Think of it like a sponge. If you take a Nafion membrane and hydrate it from a 50% dry state up to full saturation, it behaves physically differently than if you take a fully saturated membrane and dry it down to 50%.
Right, hysteresis.
Yes, the exact same moisture level produces two different operational states depending on the path it took to get there. This is where Terence Deacon's concept of constraint-based causal organization becomes vital.
Okay, but Deacon's work is...
It fits perfectly here. The interface is a system where the prior states of the water, the ions, and the surface mutually constrain their future possibilities. They lock into a sustained, path-dependent regime. It's an emergent organization that builds on its own history.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered that you are attributing polymer physics directly to the water?
I'm not separating them.
But you should! Yes, there is hysteresis, the path dependence you just described, but that phenomenon is due to the slow structural relaxation and swelling of the Nafion polymer backbone itself.
You're saying it's just the plastic bending?
Basically, yes. Nafion is a fluorinated polymer. It has a tough Teflon-like spine with little sulfonic acid side chains hanging off it. When it absorbs water, those polymer chains have to physically untangle and reorganize.
But the water drives that.
Sure, but think about trying to unshrink a wool sweater after you take it out of the wash. It takes time, physical effort, and it doesn't just snap back perfectly. A time-resolved scattering study mentioned in Dr. Saley's paper actually distinguishes between the two.
The X-ray scattering study?
Yes! It isolates the incredibly rapid diffusion of the water molecules from the much, much slower structural reorganization of the polymer matrix. The memory you are talking about isn't an emergent, mystical property of the water. Once you map out the material properties of the polymer, the apparent memory resolves into the slow, mechanical shifting of a solid matrix.
But you're artificially separating the dancer from the dance.
Physics requires isolating variables.
Not when the variables are mutually constitutive. That is exactly the reciprocal coupling Model C proposes. You can't separate the polymer's relaxation from the water's dynamics because the hydrated state changes the physical identity of the surface itself.
That's a bit philosophical, don't you think?
No, it's biophysics. The water dynamics constrain the polymer constrains the ions constrain the field. You can't just say, oh, it's the polymer, because the polymer doesn't do it without the water. And this is why this debate matters so deeply when we translate these concepts from synthetic plastics into actual living biology.
See, translation to living systems is where we need to be the absolute most rigorous and, frankly, the most cautious.
Cautious, yes, but not blind to the architecture of life. Let me give you a profound example from medical history. Look at the interstitium.
Okay, the connective tissue spaces.
Right. For decades, conventional histology missed this massive fluid-supported network of spaces in human connective tissue. Why? Because the process of preparing tissue for a slide involves fixing and dehydrating it. By drawing the tissue out to look at the solid parts, scientists collapsed the fluid spaces.
Yeah, the act of preparation destroyed the object of inquiry.
Exactly! And we make the exact same mistake in biophysics if we reduce the biological interface to dry components. If we just look at the proteins and ignore the structured water holding them apart, we miss the system.
I agree that preparation artifacts are a real methodological hurdle in biology. We've seen that time and time again.
Right. So look at something like the endothelial glycocalyx. That's the dense, fuzzy, sugar-rich coating on the inside of all our blood vessels. Or look at the inner membrane of a mitochondria where our cells generate ATP.
Highly complex environments.
Incredibly dense, highly charged surfaces where water, lipids, and proteins dynamically couple to manage permeability. You cannot understand how a mitochondria actually transduces energy purely through dry membrane potentials. The structured, ordered water at that interface is what allows the cell to act as an autopoietic system, a system that actively builds and maintains its own boundaries.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the danger of this unconstrained leap?
It's not unconstrained.
We are taking observations from a piece of synthetic Nafion in a beaker of deionized water and projecting them onto the most complex biological machines in the universe. A biological interface, like the mitochondria or the glycocalyx, repairs itself. It actively metabolizes. It constantly turns over its protein components.
Of course it does.
But an exclusion zone beside a piece of plastic is just a physical gradient playing out until it exhausts itself.
They are not biologically equivalent.
No one is saying a piece of Nafion is alive, but it gives us a baseline physical model to understand how hydrated boundaries naturally self-organize flows and forces.
But look at how easily that analogy is abused in the literature. Dr. Saley's paper specifically cites an exploratory test case involving glyphosate formulations, essentially commercial Roundup weed killer.
Oh, right, the toxicity study.
Yes. Some researchers ran an experiment where they added Roundup to a Nafion setup, and the visible exclusion zone shrank. Proponents of the new water phase immediately leapt to the conclusion that glyphosate is toxic because it disrupts living interfacial water.
Which is a huge claim.
It's an indefensible claim, based on that data. I mean, a commercial herbicide formulation is packed with harsh surfactants, salts, and chemical co-formulants that drastically alter the pH and the ionic strength of the fluid.
True. The pH drop would be massive.
Right. If a chemical changes the pH, it neutralizes the proton gradient. If the gradient shrinks, the diffusio-phoretic field shrinks, and the tracer beads naturally move back in toward the surface. Attributing that entirely conventional chemical reaction to the mystical disruption of biological water ignores standard biochemistry, it ignores standard toxicology, and it ignores basic physics.
Look, I can see that the glyphosate leap was premature, especially without decomposing the formulation to see what the surfactants were doing versus the active ingredient. But the core premise holds profound potential.
How?
Well, if a toxicant disrupts the reciprocal coupling of the interface, say, by slightly altering the nanoscopic hydration that regulates a cell membrane's permeability, the system loses its biological resilience. It loses its reserve capacity to handle the next stressor.
But we can measure that with standard tools.
But conventional toxicology might entirely miss that if it only looks at whether a chemical binds to a dry, isolated protein receptor.
Model C gives us a framework to study how small perturbations to the hydrated boundary cascade into a loss of system-level survival.
I am all for measuring the hydration boundary, but we must do it precisely, with the tools we know work. We have chemiosmotic theory for understanding the mitochondria. We have the Donnan equilibrium for modeling the glycolics.
But they assume a bulk fluid background.
We have poroelasticity, which is the study of fluid flow through porous media, to explain the extracellular matrix. We have rigorous, well-understood mechanisms for all of these environments. If you want to claim that a new overarching emergent interface model is necessary, it has to provide predictive surplus.
It does.
No, it has to mathematically predict something that my established physics and biochemistry cannot already explain.
And that brings us to the ultimate synthesis proposed in Dr. Saley's paper, which I think is where this debate actually moves forward. To summarize my position, I maintain that while conventional electrokinetics, your diffusiophoresis and your proton pumps, are an absolutely indispensable part of the equation, reducing the living interface to completely independent variables misses the functional surplus.
I just don't see the surplus.
When you look at how a cell maintains its boundary, transduces energy from its environment, and repairs itself, you cannot piece that holistic behavior together from isolated transport equations. Understanding water, surfaces, and ions as a reciprocally coupled emergent organization opens a rigorous, measurable pathway to truly understanding living boundaries.
And to summarize my stance, I maintain that the burden of proof rests heavily on those proposing new organizational principles.
Which is fair.
The beauty of physics is in its predictive power. Processes like diffusophoresis, polymer swelling, and electrochemical gradients aren't just academic buzzwords. They are mathematically precise phenomena that quantitatively predict the exact size and behavior of the exclusion zones we see in the lab. We must rigorously and exhaustively rule out these baseline variables before declaring that life requires novel aqueous states.
But I think where we fundamentally converge, and where Dr. Sahali's paper is truly brilliant, is on the proposal for an adversarial collaboration.
Oh, absolutely. The current state of the research is incredibly fragmented. We need to stop running separate experiments in separate labs with different tracer beads, different lighting conditions, and different measurement tools.
Exactly. The paper outlines a phased, pre-registered adversarial program. It calls for simultaneous multimodal measurement, meaning we need to track the optical spectrum of the water to see the molecular bonds, measure the electrical potential, track the pH changes, and watch the tracer transport, all at the exact same time in the exact same preparation.
Yeah, we take the Nafion, we clamp the proton gradient, and we see if the optical signature of the water persists. We hit it with the infrared light, but we precisely map the three-dimensional thermal field to rule out basic heating. Put everything to the test.
Exactly. We put everyone's hypotheses to the fire in a shared open data environment. That is how we unravel the true causal architecture of the hydrated interface.
It is the only way to move from controversy to true foundational science.
And it brings us right back to where we started, looking at that blueprint of the biological cell. We are slowly realizing that the blank spaces on the diagram, the watery voids we thought were just empty space, aren't so blank after all.
They are definitely busy.
Very busy. The diagnostic landscape is murky and the boundaries of life are fluid. But by leaning into that complexity, by measuring the water, the surface, and the energy together, we might just discover the exact mechanics of how physical matter actually comes alive. We'll leave it to you, our listeners, to ponder whether life's complexity requires a totally new understanding of water or just a more precise measurement of its fields.
It's a fascinating question. And there's certainly much more to explore in Dr. Sahali's paper for anyone who wants to dive into the data themselves.
Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.